The Guardian.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, providing creative tools that help you bring your ideas to life. Squarespace offers free domain names, customizable designs, drag and drop tools, and 24/7 support. Squarespace also offers seamless e-commerce solutions for you or your small business. Every design automatically includes a unique mobile experience that matches the overall style of your website, so your content will look brilliant on any device. Start your free trial today. No credit card required. As a Guardian podcast listener, you'll get 10% off your new account by using the offer code Guardian.
Hello, this is Politics Weekly. I'm Tom Clark. Coming up, the wettest weather since records began 250 years ago, and it's left much of southern England underwater. But could things have been otherwise? Who is now getting the blame? Also this week, people-powered public services. Try saying that with a mouthful of Thames water. It's Ed Miliband's answer to unwieldy state bureaucracy. But is it anything more substantial than the usual opposition flim-flam? Joining me for all of this, we have The Guardian columnists Michael White and John Harris, who are both joining us down the line. And with me in the studio is our environment expert, Damien Carrington. Welcome to you all. Now, record rainfall has drenched much of England for the past 2 weeks, and rivers have burst their banks, causing thousands of people to flee their homes. It's been left to politicians donning designer wellies and scrabbling around to respond. John Harris, you're right in the middle of it, though I'm pleased to say not actually underwater in your neck of Somerset itself. What's the scale of the damage? Are you seeing things when you venture out?
No, it's just raining all the time. I live in a part of Somerset which had it pretty bad over Christmas. I don't live that far from the Avon Valley, which looked like the Louisiana swamp, sort of well into the new year. But the now infamous Somerset levels are about three quarters of an hour's drive from here. So it's sort of talked about locally. And we are sort of fearful there are flood points around here which could go. But right now, I'm no more flooded than you are in London, I can say gratefully.
But Damien, I mean, you've been writing an awful lot about this. Lots of places in Somerset and elsewhere really are flooded in a way that we're not used to in this country. So it's a freak event, freak rain levels, but has it or has it not really been compounded by political failure?
Well, it's a good question. I mean, the first thing to say is that over a million homes have been protected by the defences in place, so they do work. We're talking about maybe 5,000, 6,000, 7,000 homes that have been flooded. And as you said, it really is the most unprecedented run of weather that anyone's ever recorded. It's not just the wettest January since 1766. It's the fact that we've had storm after storm. The meteorologists are talking about a storm factory in the Atlantic, kind of sending that over the country. So that has been very, very difficult. What I've written a lot about is flood defence spending, and the reality is that when the coalition took office, it immediately cut flood defence spending on an annual basis by £97 million. Those cuts then continued. The issue is that because climate change is making the weather worse, the risk is going up. So the government's official advisers on climate change, the Committee on Climate Change, said that if the government didn't spend £500 million extra during the spending period 2011 to 15, then the risk of flooding would go up. So I think it's fairly clear that Britain is at greater risk because of government cuts.
Mike, whether or not there's been cuts in the past, now they're saying money is no object. We're a rich country. We can afford it. Is it good? Good politics for him to start writing blank cheques like that?
Well, they're not writing blank cheques, as Patrick Winter points out in today's Guardian and other people too, that Patrick McLaughlin, the man who reads the small print, David Cameron's not particularly good at small print, I'm afraid, we've said that before here, said, well, steady on, and funny money has moved around. I mean, you know, Damien makes fair points about the cuts, but I think he's in a better position than me to say that, you know, policy changes about how you manage floods and rising sea levels and things, which, you know, in this country, the western half is high and the eastern half is low, and King John lost his jewels in the wash and all that, and the Dutch drained East Anglia. We've had a problem for centuries, and we've tackled it in different ways. And, you know, I'd be interested to know when the waters have decided whether they're going to have to make policy adjustments to try and reconcile conflicting needs to protect cities and protect farmland and villages, all the usual stuff. But frankly, Tom, I'm disappointed you haven't asked me about my flood stories, because I live in West London. I live in the floodplain. 20 years ago, London Transport published a map on all the tube stations to frighten everybody. I'm a mile from the River Thames, but I'm still in the floodplain. So in an extreme situation, then I might be in trouble too. That said, London is, generally speaking, the danger comes from the east, from high tides and strong winds from the direction of Russia, or the Soviet Union, as I still think of it. So we've been okay. It's upstream in the Thames, which is in trouble. But it's interesting how Fleet Street has got excited again and government has got excited again when the home counties are threatened. Those poor old Welsh and Cornish and Somersetians, they can half drown before they get noticed, I sometimes feel.
Mike, I spoke to Professor Colin Thorne at the University of Nottingham, who's been studying flooding for a very long time, and I said, oh, you know, it's really hit the news now, it's, you know, top of the agenda. He said, yes, holy smoke, it's hit Eton College.
John, do you think the argument about climate, which we've not heard much about in really since the recession got going in earnest, is going to start coming back? Are people going to be interested in emissions now that they're starting to see this?
Well, the Liberal Democrat Energy Secretary Ed Davey is trying that today.
Yeah.
And I think some of us were curious to know which politician would be the first to try it. Certainly it has been absent. I think there's sort of been a tension in politics, given how much all three major parties were banging on about it pre-recession. So it was always going to return. I think the danger is, particularly with the Lib Dems, who perhaps have a reputation for being a bit clumsy and pious in their rhetoric, I'm not sure right now is necessarily the best time to start tub thumping about climate change when people are still swilling out their houses. And I think in that sense it might backfire, but I'm not surprised it's happened today. And it's right that it happens. I'm just not sure politically that it'll pay many dividends right now.
In a way, it's a bit like Europe. It's very difficult to make a speech when a weight of saloon bar prejudice, and I don't say that unkindly, I spent a lot of time in saloon bars myself, saloon bar prejudice on Europe and on climate change, they all get muddled up in what I think is going to be called by Mr. Davey a diabolic cocktail, and are articulated by people as clever as Nigel Lawson. You know, we know his daughter is a beautiful and clever too, but people forget he was once the Chancellor of the Exchequer, and he said, leave Europe, and he now appears to be saying, leave the planet as well. And he gets it wrong, what do I know, but he gets it more wrong than right, although I'm in favour of people asking awkward questions. But I need to remind him, we all do, leader-writer, that the first major politician to make a major speech on the dangers of this sort of thing, yep, was Margaret Thatcher in 1998, and she was a better... 88, you're quite right, and she was a sort of scientist.
I just add that I think John's right that it's, you know, an awkward time to talk about things, but the fact is that it can change people's opinion. At Cardiff University, they've looked at people who were flooded in 2010 and then again in 2012, and they became much more concerned about climate change and actually started taking action in relation to their energy use and so on. So, you know, there is a connection in that sense, but at the political level, I'm sure it is hard.
Can I just ask you about, we always get these records, and it's with what we always get told is a random system, like the weather. You know, you get years where it's hotter and colder and all the rest of it. On the radio this morning, you had Nigel Lawson saying, well, you know, global average temperatures haven't increased much in the last 10 or 15 years. But am I right in thinking that in this country, over the last few years, we've had a whole run of years now with bad floods, starting around 2007? Because I remember the new Prime Minister, Gordon Brown, wading around flooding, and it was seen as his making briefly before he decided not to call that election.
Before he drowned.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, certainly records do get broken all the time, even if climate change wasn't changing the weather. But you look at the pattern. So are you increasing the rate at which you're breaking records? And also, is it, you know, you're always breaking high temperature records rather than low temperature records? And although, you know, climate happens over decades, 30 years probably is the minimum length you want to look at. And the records for many things aren't that good. But, you know, if you talk to any scientist, and not Nigel Lawson, then you'll find out that all of them expect extreme weather to increase. And actually, the one study that has been done showed that the floods in 2000, which struck southern England, were made twice as likely by climate change. So they did a big study on that and found that link.
I think this phrase, once in a century event happening every few years, or even more frequent, is telling in public opinion. The public gets that once-in-a-century remark being proved wrong. And as we know, with the Thames barrage in the best-defended bit of Britain, it was meant to be raised three times a year. How many times a year is it raised now, Damien? 70, 80?
Well, it nearly made a record last month. I forget what it was. It was something like kind of 20 days in a row or something. It didn't quite break the all-time record, but yes, absolutely. And actually, if you look at the reporting that's been done on the ground, you know, you find a lot of people who live in places like Somerset or in the Thames Valley whose homes have never in a century been flooded. So we are talking about extraordinary times.
And John, what do you make of the sort of witch hunt there was last week? Sorry, I say witch hunt. I'm prejudging the question against Chris Smith for having mismanaged the agency. And then you've got the kind of different politicians all taking charge until finally this week, David Cameron says, no, I'm the boss now. I'm in charge. Do you think really this is going to, is it something where people will want a scalp in the end? Or do you think people will think, well, you know, there was a lot of rain, whoever was in power would have to deal with it, it would be a bit messy?
I think what happened up to the weekend looked somewhat unseemly and looked a bit like displacement activity on the part of politicians who knew they were very, very late on the case. Speaking to you from Somerset, it is quite remarkable that the levels have been flooded really since the new year, and that just seemed to pass the political class by. They didn't seem terribly interested in it, and there is some truth in the idea that it was only when it reached the Thames Valley that people's ears pricked up.
It's a Tory county too, Somerset, isn't it?
I think what probably will register with the public is the idea that cuts have had an adverse impact on the Environment Agency, and it probably isn't the wisest way to behave. I think that probably will have cut through. The headless roll thing, I'm not sure that will work, in the sense that I think the public, as we've already said, are wise to the fact that this is huge and these are sort of huge forces which politicians can't do much about, and therefore the idea that toppling this person or that person might have any beneficial effect, I think the public will understand that that's crass and self-serving on the whole.
I was cross with Chris Smith. He's a nice man, for not getting out there earlier, not getting his wellies
on
and not defending himself. I suppose he didn't want to pick a fight, but there are ways of being visible, and he's been an elected politician 25 years before he went up to the other place, and you know, he should have known better than that. It's typical in a way. He's a nice guy, and nice guys don't always come first. They'll sack him this summer, and in a way you feel, although he makes a good case now, he's making it 6 or 7 weeks too late. He should have been leading down in Somerset, going and telling them things maybe they didn't want to hear about draining rivers, the Parrot and the Tern, all above my pay grade. But at least you have had a case to make. Go out and make it, matey.
I agree, Mike. It was late, but you know, right from the start in 2010, when the cuts came in, I spoke to Chris Smith, and he was determined to fight this from the inside. There were changes in the terms of reference for quangos in terms of how much they could speak out as well. But it was pickles on Andrew Marr on Sunday that broke his patience. The dam broke, as it were. I got in touch with him shortly after that, and he's turned that around. And I think
this was that I won't save a Chris Smith T-shirt, wasn't it?
Also saying, in this kind of sarcastic tone, I thought we were dealing with experts,
Not as nice as he looks, Pickles.
Okay, well, there's plenty more on all of this on our website, but we must now move on to drier land and examine an attempt by Ed Miliband this week to flesh out his political philosophy. He was at The Guardian to deliver the annual Hugo Young lecture. His message, that ordinary people should be at the heart of any further public sector reform. Now, Mike White, the first half of the speech was very much about equality, and he talked about his admiration for the style, if not the substance, of Mrs. Thatcher, a woman who knew where she stood. He was implying that he too knew where he stood. Are you any clearer about where he stands after the speech?
Well, a bit. I was talking to a Tory audience this week, and they were talking about values, and I said, obviously missing Mrs. Thatcher like they usually are, and they're not sure where David Cameron stands. And I said, you know, Ed Miliband has got a clear moral core. It's not clear whether it's going to do him any good, but you see in his speeches a sense of morality and fairness not far from his thoughts. I think they're always a bit sort of over-theoretical, over-intellectualized, but there are attractive features of it. Well, are we clearer? Was there a soundbite? Was there a message that people can grasp? Well, I don't think putting health and well-being boards instead of clinical commissioning groups in charge of the consultation progress for the reorganization of hospitals and wards is the kind of rallying cry I'd want to put on a badge on my lapel. And I did feel that a bit at the end of it. And the other thing I felt about the points he was making, he wants us to have access to our information, not just Ed Snowden, and he wants us to, that we should not be left isolated as individuals. If we've got problems with school or medical problems, we ought to have a sort of network which the doctor would put in charge of us with other people who've got ME or other unpleasantnesses we can suffer. And yet, you felt reading this, don't you know, Ed, this goes on a lot. If you've got, you know, heart trouble or high blood pressure or a disabled child, there's a huge support net nurtured by the internet, the good side of the internet. And you felt a bit, you're behind the curve here, Ed.
But do you think John Harris is the thought that what he's going to do on public services is just going to be quite low key, because public services aren't really where it's at, where it's going to be an election about the cost of living and the price of filling up a car?
Depends who wins the argument within the Labour Party, really. I mean, a lot of this stuff is being driven by what John Cruddas is doing in the policy review, which seems somewhat late, but is yet to really break cover, but will imminently, certainly by the sort of spring. And there is stuff that he is doing which reflects more the other side of what Ed Miliband was talking about, beyond this idea of people-powered public services, which it's early days yet, but I think it has sort of promising flashes within it. The other aspect is the idea of devolving power to local government, more than governments in recent memory have managed and so on. And John Cruddas is doing a lot of work on that, much of which, I understand, is very, very interesting. And I think when that stuff begins to take shape, it depends whether the habitually centralising, lever-pulling, crypto-Stalinist Labour Party is terribly interested. But nonetheless, I think that's an interesting agenda, and if it hold sway or begins to make headway, then interesting things, to as far as policy is concerned, might happen, but we don't know yet.
But politicians have been talking about devolving power my entire adult life in a highly centralized country. What do you do about floods? That ought to be a matter for local decision-making people. Local people know whether stuff happens, but builders get quotas to build on the floodplain to meet Whitehall demands. Whitehall controls the purse strings. You know, you get very cynical about this, I'm afraid. I've heard it too often. Devolution is right, but there's, you know, it's not easy.
So, John, one question I wanted to put to you in particular, remembering how you were frustrated after having been taken in by Gordon Brown's phrase about a town square being more than a marketplace.
Yeah.
Are you worried that Ed Miliband's doing the same thing here, that he's putting forward a phrase like people-powered public services, which sounds nice to people like you, and then when he's in power, isn't going to be quite clear on what it means?
Well, that's the dilemma that faces us every time us political journalists wake up in the morning, I suppose, whether these people are going to follow through on their rhetoric. I suppose what makes this more interesting and gives me slightly more cause for hope is the fact that there are elements now close to Ed Miliband within the Labour Party who are driving this agenda, and also actually very big figures within Labour and local government who also want this to happen. And the other thing is that perhaps what might weaken the hand of the crypto-Stalinist centralisers is the idea that these sorts of solutions that involve devolution of power and boosting the role of local government and so on, in theory at least, are much more cost-effective. And if you've got the prospect of a Labour government working within a tighter fiscal envelope, the idea, for example, that you say that the DCLG is a horrible centralising monstrosity and you ought to do away with a lot of it and hand back a great deal of its powers to local government, the same may apply to the Department of Work and Pensions, for example. These are sort of radical, interesting thoughts that, because of the fiscal situation, might have a bit more purchase. So I think, you know, they're interesting times in which some of this stuff might have more force than it has hitherto, and the fact that John Cruddas and the policy review is loudly making these sorts of noises make the whole thing very, very interesting. It doesn't feel to me, for that reason, quite like those flashes you got of this stuff in the past where David Miliband would talk about double devolution, or Hazel Blears would use these horrible phrases like subsidiarity.
Yeah.
And Gordon would throw out these little
Mussolini's phrase, subsidiarity. You leave that alone.
You know, there is a bit more substance to this. There's a bit more momentum behind it. We're not quite in the place where Gordon used to issue these little eight-word sound bites and we'd stare at them thinking that the future of social democracy somehow was in there somewhere. So I feel slightly more optimistic in that sense.
See, we don't have... John talked about having time on the Cruddas review. There isn't any... There isn't any time. I'm reminded sometimes of Private Eye cover after Michael Foot lost the 83 election. They got Footy waving his stick on Hampstead Heath with his dog shouting, "Hang on, I haven't finished yet."
Mike, one of the criticisms some people made of the speech was, you know, there wasn't a kind of bold, sweeping overall vision for the public services in the sense that we've grown used to with Lansley, and then in, you know, even more general terms with Tony Blair, who used to sort of, you know, have people do up these PowerPoint charts about what an enabling state would be. But does that matter? I mean, one thing I thought was quite attractive about the speech is that I think that people who work in public services are a bit tired out of having a new grand vision imposed on them every week, and something a bit more incremental might be quite useful.
Yeah, the grand vision that needs to be imposed on them that they're there in the public services, I'm afraid, is a familiar one, which Ed didn't address either, which is that, you know, in all sorts of ways, the public service unions and public service staff, many of whom are wonderful, but the environment in which they work isn't particularly customer-friendly, if I can use the word customer. I mean patient and pupil and, you know, other users of the public services. And, you know, a mindset which has to change, which has to be more patient-friendly. You see it. I mean, the frustrating thing is you have great experiences. We all do, people listening, of the public services. A friend of mine said how brilliantly he was treated for his heart attack in a conversation this week, and I've seen it. I was in a lovely ward to get to have a biopsy in December. They were really nice, and the biopsy was very encouraging, so everybody can relax. But then you see some bloody awful behaviour, and you hear shocking things done, and in a way, dare I say it, Jeremy Hunt is onto something when he talks about the culture. It's not all about blaming Labour. He does plenty of that as well. But, you know, that people have got to say patients matter. And that's an area, Ed, in this speech, tiptoed past because big trade unions, they're a bit uneasy about that sort of stuff. Aren't we, Bob Crowe?
Do you think that's unfair, John?
Yes, I do.
Okay.
Why? I think... Because I think what, and there were reasonably substantial references to this in what Ed Miliband said. Unquestionably, that point about patient and pupil and parent voice becomes more and more pressing with every year because of the fact that that's the way that we deal with the world now, via social media, among other things. People have an expectation of engagement and
yep.
being heard, and the idea that they spontaneously they'll be in touch with all sorts of people in the same boat who might have something to say that the public services won't listen to.
And that's good.
That's all true. So politics and the way that the state organises, sooner or later, are going to have to catch up with it. What we've had for the last 15 or 20 years, as far as New Labour and the current government is concerned, is an increasingly dysfunctional answer to that, which is that in response to the expectation of power and voice and influence on the part of patients and parents and so on, we'll give it all to Serco and G4S and Capita and all these people, and somehow this is a bit like the market, even though it's not because it's monopoly power, that might somehow bridge this gap. Now, what Ed Miliband said, really, was that you often feel like a speck in front of a monolith when you're dealing with the orthodox public sector state. And the problem with the privatized shadow version of that is you equally feel like a speck in front of a monolith. And what we have to do now is work towards arrangements which perhaps reflect the way that people feel about themselves and their role in the world and give them that sense that they're being listened to more. This is a work in progress, as Michael said. It seems very late. There isn't much time to work through what it means. But there was some justification for the fact that online in particular, there were a lot of Labour voices said, well, this sounds like, I dread to use this phrase, a sort of third way beyond this privatise it or leave the orthodox centralised state
leave
as it
alone.
Is. And I think that's interesting. It's fertile ground and it needs exploring. And at least there are people in the Labour Party now who are prepared to do
There's an interesting point there, which is we are, just as 30 years ago we saw the limits of nationalisation of the car industry or the steel industry, we're now beginning quite clearly to see the limits of markets.
Very true.
And when John says Serco or Capita, all the energy companies, the worst example in many ways of state-subsidised monopoly, people can see there are good things come out of the private sector disciplines and private sector attitudes, including very often a better attitude towards customers. There are bad things as well, and we're beginning to see what doesn't simply work, and Virgin Trains on the West Coast versus public sector on the East Coast. That I find an encouraging debate because we can all see what works and what doesn't.
Okay, so Damien, seeing as we've got you here, I'd just like to give you a final word on Ed Miliband and the environment. You followed him since he was the climate change and energy secretary. His most senior job that he got to in the last government, he was seen as very determined on that. And in his early speeches as Labour leader, it was something he always mentioned. There wasn't so much of it in the speech this week. I just wondered, in general, do you think it's an issue he's keeping up the pressure on or not?
I've spoken to him on many occasions about it, and I genuinely believe that he gets it and cares about it. And you know, Mike mentioned earlier that he does have a kind of a moral core. I believe that too, having spoken to him, and I believe he's demonstrated in other areas that he's prepared to, you know, be unpopular with, you know, the Mail or other papers in order to do, as he says, the right thing. I think the judgment is that, you know, it's not an issue that's top of people's minds at the moment. I also think Ed Balls, the Shadow Chancellor, isn't particularly engaged on this issue, so whether he brings it to the fore or not.
They never are, those economists, are they? Rascals.
Okay, well, the producer was Phil Maynard. I'm Tom Clark, and thanks very much to Mike and John and to Damien, and thanks very much to all of you for listening. Bye-bye.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, providing creative tools that help you bring your ideas to life. Squarespace offers free domain names, customizable designs, drag and drop tools, and 24/7 support. Squarespace also offers seamless e-commerce solutions for you or your small business. Every design automatically includes a unique mobile experience that matches the overall style of your website, so your content will look brilliant on any device. Start your free trial today. No credit card required. As a Guardian podcast listener, you'll get 10% off your new account by using the offer code Guardian.